Okay, we've talked about the first three steps: recognize authorship, own your story, and assess the plot and storylines. We're going to talk about what's beginning in Module 2, the step four, decide what to change. And I think as you come to know more about how your minds and brains operate, you'll be way better coaches. We're going to talk about choice architecture, specifically about identity, choice, and the dynamics of mind and brain. So here's a precept for this step. Part of the struggle to get people to embrace change is a challenge because the methods to facilitate change are often contrary to how our minds and brains work. And despite being presented with ample evidence of how change can be beneficial, many people don't make changes even when they know it's in their best interest. So it's important to know your present, your future story is yours to write. So let's talk just a little bit about identity. Your identity is not your behavior or your habits. A habit is not a definition. It's simply a choice that gets repeated, a collection of repetitions. If you define yourself by what you do or by your habits, it will make it harder to change. We listen to other people's stories, how they make up who they are, what they need, including from us, how they teach us to respond to them. People become the stories of who they think they are. These stories may leave something out, from a blind spot even to the shadow side of what's wonderful. And that something can become an abiding quest, maybe a want or need, that can actually define. Remember the equation from last seminar: belief drives behavior, behavior drives performance. Here are a couple of examples of basic storylines that show how a belief can lead to behavior. A wish for approval or acceptance. It can lead, on the one hand, to super achievement and benevolent acts, or it can lead to someone taking too many risks or even afraid to take risk, or someone never saying no, promising too much and becoming depleted. Another example, the need for harmony can power affiliation and social achievement. It can also make it difficult for people to stand up for themselves when they have a different opinion, or even to disregard their own need. Remember my client from last session who said yes to everyone except himself and his self-care. So for this step, decide what to change, we're going to add an equation. It captures the principle that you either create your reality or agree to it. And this is the equation: event plus response equals outcome. Every outcome you experience in life is a result of how you respond to an event in your life. Achievement is an outcome. It's the result of responding in particular ways. It's not what happens to us, but our response to what happens to us that makes a significant difference. So, if you don't like the outcomes you're experiencing, you have a couple of possible things to focus on: the E or the R, the event or the response. So, if you focus on the event, you can blame the event. Well, sorry I'm late, the traffic on I-10 was terrible. Or my personal favorite, the assembly instructions just didn't make sense. Or if I get really desperate, you know, they left out a couple of parts here. Or you can focus on the R, the response. You can change your response to the events to get the outcome you want. But to do that, you have to assume total responsibility for writing your own story. And once more, remember this essential principle for ownership of your story. In adulthood, we either create or agree with everything that happens to us that we experience. Whatever we experience, we either create it or agree with it, or we simply change it. You worked out, so now you feel more energy and alertness. You didn't attend to marketing, so now your business is slumping. Choice is part of a mindset. The antithesis of choice is also a mind set with its own text. This is how that can sound: fate, luck, circumstance, bad traffic, things just happen, I can't do it. The absence of the awareness of choice limits possibility. And here's a footnote. Whatever you're doing that you feel you can't control is your addiction. You can be addicted to a substance, a behavior, a person, a process, a certain kind of relationship, compromised results. And have you noticed that people specialize? They keep having the same success or the same problem. If the success is with money and business startups, we see a serial entrepreneur. If the problem is with relationships, it keeps getting repeated. Catherine Ann Porter wrote, "His mother rejected him. 1,000 women since have paid for that." Now, here's another notion to consider. First for yourself, then you'll recognize it more readily when you hear it from a client. What you seek is camouflaged in what you fear. Let me say that a different way. Show me an obstacle, and I'll show you a desire. For example, show me clutter, I'll show you blocked energy that desires release. We always create the outside to match the inside. So, in other words, rather than strategizing to overcome or avoid or defeat an obstacle, simply consider not creating it. The obstacle is there when you create it. You can use your energy to generate something else instead. So this is a premise of this way of thinking about we create our own stories. The obstacle is not to be contended with, how we figure out how to get around it, how to obviate it, how to defend against it, whatever we decide to do. Consider that it's there when we create it. It's not there if we don't create it. So here's an example of that. A man says, "I only fall for unavailable women." They're unavailable because they already have partners, or they're emotionally unavailable. Since he's afraid of women and intimacy, he needed an obstacle to be in place so he could allow himself awareness of his desire. Now, there's a secret here. An obstacle is the unconscious mnemonic of desire. It reminds you of what you want, but it makes it safe to want if you're afraid. Here's an illustration. I saw a cartoon of a dog. The dog was straining at its leash, barking ferociously at a cat, as if to say, "Just let me at him." Now, the next frame, the cat was at least as big as the dog, really mean looking. And then in the third frame, all of a sudden, in the middle of a ferocious bark, the leash snapped. So the dog was free to go after the cat. He looked astonished, scared to death. He quickly ran back, grabbed the leash, tied a triple knot, then strained again to say, "Just let me at him." So, when you find yourself focusing on an obstacle, for example, "I can't find time to exercise," reflect on the underlying desire. Here's a coaching principle. When you're ready to consider that you create the obstacle, you're also ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. Imagine what it would be like not to create your obstacles. So in this session, we're going to look at what's involved in deciding to change. And then in the next couple of sessions, we'll apply it to mapping changes and authoring new experiences. So first, let's consider how the brain opposes change. This is, I believe, crucial to understand when we engage change. Both our minds and brains automatically resist change. Findings from the cognitive sciences can inform how to change a personal or business story. So let's first look at how the brain opposes change and then how to use this information to facilitate success in mentor coaching. The brain has a mind of its own. When you feel with one side of the brain and think on the other, you need a map. So there are 10 precepts that I believe can be really useful to consider about how our brains work. Each of these, I think, will help you in guiding someone to write a new story. The mechanisms are a little complex, but the principles are so simple they're almost elusive. One, these are all how the brain opposes change so that we can use it in order to facilitate change. One, change generates discomfort. And we've talked about this. Part of the reason for this resistance to change is due to a fact far more challenging than just getting someone to decide to do things differently. Any attempt to modify behavior and habits requires an actual rewiring of the brain. Activities that we've repeated that have become habits are hardwired into the brain. Neuronal pathways and neural nets, the highways and villages in our brain, have become etched by repeated habits to create efficient operation to make routine behaviors easy. We don't have to think about how we drive to work the same day, the same way each day, as we've talked about. Because of this default mode, we can think about other things or listen to a book. And this default mode becomes energy efficient because the brain's freed up to do other things. So the brain is amazingly adaptive. It makes routine behaviors energy efficient by hardwiring and growing new neurons for that purpose, to make it the default mode. Now, when these habits are confronted and have to change, the basal ganglia, the midbrain where the automatic pilots are, get disrupted. We feel discomfort. The prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, has to get busy with way more energy and attention to process this thinking. And it's work to change. The natural inclination is to resist the stress of change and to preserve the default habit. The brain naturally resists change because to hardwire behavior saves energy, so it opposes what's been adaptive from an evolutionary sense to change. The promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode. The brain just doesn't know that yet, so our minds have to lead the way. Some remarkable new research shows that consistently repeating new experiences even alters gene expression. In fact, Ray Kurzweil, I heard him say this in person. He said this also in The Singularity is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology, a revolutionary book. Civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them. The number two way our minds and brains oppose change. Change creates dissonance. So, couple this brain inclination to keep doing the same efficient routine with the mind's inclination to see what we expect to see. We see what we expect, what our radar has been coded for. We do this by screening information based on expectation. In fact, when we don't see what we expect to see, the brain's error detection mechanism reads as if something's wrong. And this is an actual location in the brain that fires when we see something that's out of the ordinary. It's located right next to the emotional center of the brain. So our brains have an innate capacity to detect what neuroscientists call errors. That's the difference between what we expect and what we actually perceive. It registers as a sense that something's not quite right. And at times it can be abrupt and explicit. Remember, for example, the experience of absentmindedly going to the refrigerator to get a drink of milk and abruptly discover that you're sipping orange juice because you were thinking about something. When this happens, neural firings disrupt expected flow and use brain energy. So this error detection signal that something is wrong simply means that it's different than we expected. So we have to take this coupling into account when strategizing and guiding about change with our clients. When something is done that engages change, it's going to disrupt the usual order. It's going to create a firing in our client's error detection mechanism, and that's going to read as a disruption. So it can be read as, for example, well, my gut feeling is this is the wrong thing to do, or my intuition says this is not the right time. Now, this discomfort needs to be read accurately, because how we experience something, how we read a feeling, determines the mindset that we boot up to process it. So this is where it's important to recognize that The discomfort is because of doing something new and different because we've not done it before. We've moved from the superhighway of the familiar to creating a new pathway that we don't know, that's not certain, that's uncomfortable. It would be way more comfortable to stay on that superhighway even though it doesn't go where we want it to, because change is disruptive. So now the good news, and you have to leave your comfort zone to change. That something doesn't feel comfortable in the beginning is not an indication to stop. It simply is a recognition, a signpost, that you are doing something new and different. That way of reframing it with a client can help them impose that way of looking at and developing a new model to process their experiences. Now, the good news, the brain contains neural machinery in this same medial frontal cortex to recognize and to correct errors, to optimize behavior, in other words. This means that these frontal neurons also become active after negative feedback or diminished reward. So it also responds to mistakes, in other words. And this is great if we remember to discern whether it's a mistake or simply a neural response and printout to change itself. That's the distinction. And that's the way to help a client recognize and calibrate that experience, and especially incorporate a new experience when change is involved. Now, number three. The brain is a prediction machine. So here's an exercise. If you have a pen, I want to give you some numbers. 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, and 8. What's missing? Usual responses are 3 and 6, or even multiples of 3. Well, consider this. Nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of 6 numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head. It's informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story. Sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything recurs 2 times in a row, the brain predicts a third repetition. A stock goes up 2 quarters in a row, the brain predicts a third rise will follow. In fact, extrapolation, predicting the future based on the past, has been called the most common mistake in investing. J. Paul Getty said there are 3 elements to getting rich. Get up early, work hard, find oil. Now, you can see how brain prediction of pattern is also the basis of many jokes. Listing 2 things, then a third non sequitur. Set up, payoff. The human brain automatically imposes patterns and predictions on repeated events. So, this makes it a challenge to override both emotion and brain patterns to make wise and balanced decisions. So, we need to be sure we predict, we envision the right things. 4, behavioral reinforcements can backfire. Let's say you're the COO of a company determining a policy about employees being on time. Which do you think works better, threats or reinforcements? The answer, neither. Both are likely to backfire. Studies show 2 things. Threats work short-term but draw attention away from work and back to the problem that created the behavior. And secondly, recognition for someone being on time actually raises anxiety and reinforces the neural patterns connected with lateness. So in other words, both focus on the negative, and we get what we focus on, not what we want. And a focus can be either negative or positive. The unconscious doesn't know negative from positive, just the focus. We assume people will receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Not so, says the brain. In fact, being told what to do can result in an innate opposition. The brain's natural homeostasis, avoid change. 5, motivation is not essential. Someone does not have to be motivated to do something. I know you've heard your friends, your relatives. I hear this again and again in Coach the Coach training at Coach Training Alliance. Someone will begin a session saying, I just need to get motivated to lose weight. I need to get motivated to work out. I need to get motivated to, you know, eat a healthier diet. You don't have to get motivated. Motivation is not a prerequisite. In fact, it can limit movement ahead if you assume that it's a prerequisite. I work, as you may know, with pro athletes and actors, and they, every day, athletes in the off season, essentially every day, 6 days a week, they work out at a gym. Now, they're not motivated to do that. Almost everyone, they are not motivated to do it. But they do it because they know they need to do that in order to do what's next. So the only thing that you need, rather than motivation, is a plan and sticking to it. We're going to return to that in terms of how we look at motivation at a later point. So, 6, emotions change brain functioning. Anxiety or fear shifts someone into a survival mode that can prevent fluid learning and understanding. Alarm signals like fear, anxiety, anger, just even irritability and impatience can shanghai attention of the frontal lobes and cause them to forfeit optimum functioning. Now, when emotions are triggered, brain chemicals are released that can prompt toward action and away from creativity and assessing knowledge. This is why some kinds of self-talk is limited. Change your thoughts, change your behavior will work until emotion gets involved. And as soon as emotion is triggered, reason can run and logic leaves. So this, let me give you an example of this. What we thought for a long period of time was that the reward system of the brain, dopamine, is what occurs in terms of a reward. When somebody does something that results in a good feeling and a reward, that's triggering dopamine. Well, that's not the way it happens. It happens just the reverse. Whenever someone anticipates something like spending money, or eating a favorite food, or a pleasurable activity, the anticipation is what triggers dopamine. For example, people were hooked up to an fMRI machine, and when they approached a slot machine, the people who were passionate about gambling, when they approached a slot machine before they ever touched it, the dopamine spike was there. So they continue to try to keep it alive. That's what happens when people compulsively shop or compulsively eat. They trigger dopamine, so they get the anticipatory reward before they ever spend money, so they keep doing it to try to sustain that same experience. 7 of how brains work, stimulation and performance. Stimulation, also known as a little bit of stress, can enhance memory and learning. The things that excite us and provide a little bit of stress short-term enhance learning. Now, the time window is very limited here, up to maybe 2 hours at most. For longer periods of time, especially 4 hours or more, things go the other direction. Learning capacity declines with stimulation at this point called stress. This means that with sustained stress, people can make bad, emotionally charged decisions. And the most important thing in all of this and with our clients is to help them to regulate states of mind and manage emotions so that they can enter an optimum state of mind for performance. This is important enough. We're going to spend an entire seminar. There's an entire module on mastering states of mind. So why is that important? Well, just a few assorted examples. Stress contributes to 85% of all medical problems. That's from Cooper Wellness Program. 70 to 80% of physician visits are stress-related, U.S. Public Health Survey. 52% of executives will die of diseases related to stress, Cooper Wellness. Stress is the number one reason behind sickness from work, the G Publishing Survey. And finally, stress undermines work productivity in 9 of 10 companies, Industrial Society Survey. Number 8, closure to novelty. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. Now, the major factor is not their age, but how long somebody's been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business. People who stay in one place, in one position, can get most entrenched. A place, for example, that I see this kind of closure to novelty, this at times resistance to change, is family succession of business. A patriarch founder passes the company he started 36 years ago to 2 children to own and manage. It's a challenge because everyone involved changes roles, relationships, and identity. Now, these last 2 principles I think are absolutely huge for coaching. 9. Neurogenesis is the creation of new brain cells. What we know now, 2 things above all others create neurogenesis: an enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment is intellectual and emotional stimulation that actually creates more complex brain structure. That's what we do with our clients: co-create, stimulate thinking, challenge, story bus, nudge. The hippocampus is the part of the brain especially connected with creativity and memory. It's in the midbrain. It's whenever any stimulus comes in, it's sorted by the amygdala, passed on to the hippocampus to attach meaning. Mice from an enriched environment have a 15% increase in their hippocampal cells, things that are challenging, intellectually stimulating, in mice intelligence at least, creates a growth in the number of cells in the organ of the body that has to do with creativity and memory. Physical exercise increased the number of cells in the hippocampus by almost 100%. It almost doubled with exercise. And again, the hippocampus is the primary site of creativity and memory. Now, here's an addendum. In very recent studies, University of Hamburg medical students as well as London taxicab drivers were studied in non-invasive studies, and these findings were replicated almost to the exact numbers. Now, another finding: chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. In other words, the number of cells, especially in the hippocampus, decreases, so this affects both memory and creativity. And 10, neuroplasticity simply means that the brain can remodel itself. This has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region of the brain that originally had one job can be trained to perform another. The brain can reassign job descriptions of neurons. For example, for stroke patients who have a dysfunctional arm, the traditional therapy is that the arm that doesn't work as well is put in a sling to protect damage from occurring. In studies that have now been replicated, when stroke patients have their good arm put in a sling, it takes an average of 10 days before they regain significant use of an arm they thought otherwise would hang useless. The brains of these individuals recruited nearby neurons to perform the functions of the damaged ones. Another example of zoning laws changing in the brain, but also the amount of cortical real estate that a body part claims can be changed depending on its use. An expert braille reader has significantly greater area handling the finger reading braille than someone who doesn't. Same with the dominant hand of a classical guitarist. much larger portion of the brain handling that function. Now, the good news, we are not hardwired for life. With new experiences, new neuronal pathways and new neural networks are formed. New highways to new communities in your brain. So, how do we counter the brain resistance to change? So, let's reframe that question. How best can we mentor coach someone? So, here's what neuroscience teaches us about mentor coaching. First, and this is also in your outline, everyone has prior knowledge that affects how they hear and respond to new information. Existing knowledge is the beginning of new knowledge. It's where new learning starts because it can't happen in any other way. In other words, you have to resonate with and understand with where someone is and join them in that place and then go someplace new together in order for someone to change. Two, the prior knowledge is physical, real, and persistent as a neuronal pathway in the brain. In other words, whenever we know a fact or have a belief, it's an anatomical reality in our brains. And you can't just have another fact or another belief presented and expect it's going to overwrite the one that is already there in a part of an anatomical network and pathway in the brain. But it can change. It's an inside job. It's a process to go through this, and this is exactly what we're talking about doing and why I believe it's important to add to the tools and methods and principles of coaching the ideas about how our minds and brains work and to synthesize and integrate that in terms of helping someone facilitate change. Three, if we ignore reality, it will get in the way of new information and change. So as we mentor, coach, and co-create change, we have to start where the client is, not where we are. We can't provide the tools for solving problems before both coach and client know exactly what the problems are as the client perceives them. That's why fixing doesn't work. You can't just list four reasons an idea is wrong and expect it's going to rearrange somebody's neural network. And if you tell somebody the answers, not only does it not agree with what is already in their brain, but also it activates the error detection mechanism because that just doesn't sound right. So we have to be with where someone is. Some of you have heard me mention this before. The very best, the most succinct way I have ever heard this put is many, many years ago, I offered an executive woman an analysis and interpretation, and I thought it was a pretty savvy interpretation. I thought it was going to help her, you know, really grasp something. And she paused, and I knew something was up. And she raised up on her right elbow, turned back, and looked at me in the analytic chair, and she said, "No, Kruger, first you've got to be with me before I can go someplace new with you." The most brilliant and succinct way of saying this that I've ever heard. We have to resonate with and join the experience of the client before we can go someplace new with them. Four, partly because it's complex and partly because it's subjective reality and personal, someone is not always aware of their prior knowledge. And prior knowledge is concrete, as we've just talked, an actual pathway in the brain. So we need to begin with discovering what prior knowledge and beliefs someone has and begin with the concrete. Specific examples can help someone become ready for concepts or abstractions or broad principles. So, here are some specific ways that we can help our clients understand and change their minds and brains. One, begin where the client is. You have a better chance of connecting with the neuronal networks of your clients if you use concrete examples that they already know, their own experiences. No one can understand something that's unconnected, at least in some way, in existing knowledge. And do this brief exercise with me. Draw a circle. Inside that circle, put a stick figure. Now, that stick figure is your client. Your challenge is to get inside that circle for a client to really listen to you. You remain on the outside, they won't listen to you. The most beneficial and effective way of getting in that circle is an empathic resonance with their experience. You resonate with and articulate in some way their challenge. You get them to describe what their challenge is, and you join with them in that. Then you can go someplace new. Your first step, the first challenge, is to get inside the circle so that you connect with the client where they are and understand things the way they see them. Two, help them learn more about what they already know. We begin with where someone is, their existing neuronal networks, for them to describe the experience and their ideas and elaborate about basically their story. Three, highlight positive attributes, existing neuronal networks like natural talents or behaviors or patterns. Four, don't focus on mistakes, because remember, focus will enhance neuronal etching. A focus aligns the energy field of the brain, so it should be on something useful, on something positive. Five, correct mistaken couplings. Understand and build on existing networks. So, let sleeping dogs and old, unuseful networks lie. Encourage a client to develop metaphors, stories, connections of their own. Stories, analogies, metaphors, they all create maps. So, to set the stage, engage people to explore possibilities outside what they usually expect. In other words, to keep from just repeating an attachment pattern, an emotional pattern, a behavior pattern. People need to experience what it's like to view things differently. And remember Ben Fletcher's study at the University of Hertfordshire, to engage volunteers to do things differently, to be aware, to be conscious of choice, and then to act on it, and then to reflect on changes. Eight, the brain has an intrinsic desire to create novel connections. So here's an amazing paradox of the brain. While the brain pushes back like a two-year-old against new or different information patterns, remember it's an organ of homeostasis with tracks laid down that we call habits and an error detection mechanism to watch over and say, this is not what I expect. It also has an intrinsic desire to create novel situations. So how does this work? When someone solves a problem or has an aha experience or an insight, adrenaline is released. When someone has an aha moment, a moment of insight, three different parts of the brain light up that vaults someone into a more synthetic and integrative and creative state of mind. And it sets up a desire to continue this. Now, consider the opposite. Someone is given a fact, information, a directive, orders. Nothing happens. No part of the brain lights up. So, this is why we want to think about asking questions and co-create innovative ideas rather than providing answers. Nine. You have to recognize and take ownership of your experience. You won't believe things to be different just because you're told, or if it's a theory, you have to act on it. This is putting it in an output channel. This is what makes it complete, to process something and then put it in an output channel. We learn better. We retain and remember better when we put it in an output channel. We'll return to that because I think that's important. I know we touched on that before. 10. When we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Here's an example. Some NASA astronauts did a training experiment in which they had headgear with a visual apparatus that created an upside-down image. Consistently, 24 hours a day, everything was exactly reversed. So they had to move about really carefully everything they did, they had to think about and kind of reverse in their brain. So they moved about incredibly carefully and thought about everything they did. Then, day 25, they noticed something remarkable. Their brains automatically made the adjustments. They didn't have to anymore. Their brains had developed new neural pathways and had rewired so that everything appeared normal, even though the apparatus was still transposing everything. Now, another group of astronauts in the headgear were given a day off out of their helmets at day 15. When they put the headgear back on, it took them 25 days from that point on of putting the headgear back on to make the adjust for their brains to make the adjustment. And I emphasize this because of consistency and continuity in making a new habit. And 11, final. Give attention to a new experience or a new way of doing things consistently and repetitively. And this kind of follows from the NASA experiment. What we do in coaching, and for example, meeting weekly with our clients, offers increments, small amounts of change, of focus on stepwise, on the process itself of writing a new story. This process, I believe, yields better learning than a one-time intensive training unless there are follow-up programs. Here's an example. Some penguins wanted to learn to fly and got together and hired a coach. They went to an all-day seminar. They set SMART goals, visualized, wrote affirmations, looked at mutually supporting motivations. After a few hours, one penguin flew a short distance. Others were encouraged. Eventually, by the end of the day, they were each flying around the room. When the seminar was over, they left and walked home. Change is a process, not an event.